Coming up next on Is It Just Speculation? In 2020, you actually won the Marcel Benoist Award, and that's referred to as the Swiss Nobel Prize. What was it like being honored for your work after decades of work as the 100th prize recipient?
Well, it was, of course, a great joy and great honor. And it's also with a big sense of humility, because it is so that there is a person gets honored. But of course, that person was just one component of the accomplishments of a whole group. I mean, the way life science research today functions, it's highly connected worldwide. And the results that we and the advances we were able to realize as a research group over decades was through the contributions of literally hundreds of skilled and dedicated individuals.
Hey everyone, it's Chris, the host of Is It Just Speculation, the podcast where we take a look at the gray areas of life, where things aren't always black and white or as they appear to be. Today, we're actually talking to Professor Emeritus Rudy Abersold, who is a biologist and a specialist in proteomics, and he did win the 2020 Marcel Benoist Award, which is commonly referred to as the Swiss Nobel Prize. He was the 100th recipient of that award. So stick around and learn some more information as we tackle a previous topic that we covered with Kira Dineen of DNA Radio. With Professor Rudy Abersold, we go into HeLa cells and how their changes over time might impact studies. Stick around for more. Hello, Professor Abersold.
Hi, Chris.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, thanks. And you?
I'm doing all right. So first of all, thanks for joining. I know it's probably a random request to talk about a study you did in, I think, 2019, but I appreciate it.
I'm happy to do it. It's actually interesting. It's an interesting situation.
If you want to go ahead and tell everybody who you are and what you do.
My name is Rudy Abersold. I'm a scientist in the life sciences. I was a professor at ETH Zurich until 21. And our field of research was the analysis of the protein contents of cells and tissues, with the idea to find out how these proteins cooperate into carry out biochemical functions, and what goes wrong with the proteins when a cell is shifting from being in a normal, healthy state into a disease-affected state, for instance, into a tumor cell.
Okay. So I had previously discussed the HeLa cells, specifically in a prior episode, and one of the unknowns to me was if HeLa cells have been reproduced for, I believe, around 70 years since Henrietta's death. Have there been any signs of degradation or mutations? And one, how have those cells changed from the original batch? And two, what did your group study find on multi-omic measurements of heterogeneity in HeLa cells across laboratories? That's a mouthful, by the way. But what did your team find?
So we found that these cells, as you say, have been in, I mean, that's the historical record. These cells have been in culture, that means out of a person in a particular broth, in a fluid, cell culture fluid, continuously for about 70 years. And they divide every about once a day to once every 30 hours. So you can imagine that these cells have divided a very, very large number of times since originally they were generated from Henrietta Lacks. And so the reason we did this study, I'm coming back to your question, what we found. I thought I would first explain why we did this study. And this was actually exactly the reason The reason we did this study is exactly to answer the question that you posed, and that is, how stable are these cell lines? So are these cells, as we have them now in the laboratory and work with them, are these the same cells from there? Of course, they're not the same cell, but are they identical in their molecular composition, but also in the way they function as they were 70 years ago? And the expectation actually is that they're not the same, because every time a cell divides, there's a certain likelihood that its genomic material gets varies, so that there's mistakes or more generally speaking, alterations imposed on these cells, simply because the whole process of duplicating the whole genome is extremely complicated and is error prone. So there is certain likelihood that errors occur, and these errors would then show up as differences, alterations in the genome. And so the reason we did this study actually was initially not for biological reasons, but for more science policy reasons. Because you may have also talked to people or read about the so-called reproducibility crisis in the life sciences. So the reproducibility crisis basically means that if two or several research groups carry out the same experiment in their own laboratories, they may not always get the same results. And this is actually true. This has been fairly substantially investigated, and there have been community-based studies done that the same experiment was repeated in different labs with sometimes different results. And so this is a fact. And we wanted, and now this fact is frequently interpreted in the way that scientists don't know what they're doing, or even worse, that they're all cheaters, that they make stuff up. And we wanted to, actually the initial intent of the study was to take cells from different laboratories, HeLa cells, so these ostensibly the same cells. People do, I mean, there's thousands of laboratories worldwide that do experiments with HeLa cells. And we so we contacted a number of laboratories that do experiments with HeLa cells and asked them to send us a sample of the cells they had in their laboratory at that time and did experiments with. And so a number of labs complied and agreed to do that. And then we took these cells and grew them for a short time in our laboratory under exactly the same condition, same medium, same condition, same technician, same incubator. And then we established, we measured their composition of the molecules that constitute the cells. So the genome, the proteome, and now also phosphoproteome, but it's not, the details here is not important. We wanted to see, are these cells actually the same cells, even though they have the same name? And if they are not the same, if they diverged over time in these laboratories, we wanted to ask, do they carry out the same function? So if you do an experiment on these cells, do they give the same answer? And because you could argue, of course, yeah, the cells are not quite the same. There's some genes that have mutated, and there's some proteins that have changed in, as a consequence of these mutations. But by and large, the cells are still the same. And if you do an experiment, you still get among these variants of the cells still the same results. And so we did these measurements. We did measurements at various levels of gene expression, genome, transcripts, proteins, phosphoproteins. And we saw that these cells are not the same. So they're substantially different in their molecular composition, but we also measured, do they give the same answer if we do the same experiment with them? And the answer is no, they don't. So this, what the consequence of that is, that if different laboratories do experiments with ostensibly the same cells, they are if they're not very, very careful and track exactly how many divisions these cells have been doing in their laboratory or before they came to the laboratory, then that they are, these different groups would work with substantially different cells, even though they have the same name. And because they are substantially different, they're also likely to generate different results. So what we basically showed, and that was the intent initially of the study, was that if different people get different results by doing the same experiment, that it is very likely not because they cheat or they don't know what they're doing, they're not careful, but because they're actually doing a different experiment, because the cells have basically shifted over time from what initially they were doing to something different. And we could even show that in as little as 3 months, which is not a long time in biological experimentation, the cells diverged quite substantially at the level of the genome. So even if, so one could say that if a doctoral student, a PhD student, would do an experiment with HeLa cells at the beginning of his or her thesis, and then towards the end when they're writing up the thesis, maybe the supervisor says, well, you have to repeat this experiment. This was not, something was wrong with it, or you have to just repeat it. That student will almost certainly not do the same experiment again and is therefore likely get a slightly or substantially different result.
So in this study specifically, what was your main role?
My main role was to come up with the idea to collect the cells. And then a postdoc, Yancheng Liu, he did all the work in the laboratory. And then, of course, we analyzed the data together and we wrote up the paper together. So my role was that of a basically group leader and supervisor.
So, you know, this has been being reproduced for about 70 years. Why now, or has there been other studies before with maybe less advanced techniques to measure the differences?
Well, one reason is exactly that these techniques have not been around for very long. I mean, genomic techniques have been around now for quite a while, but not so generally accessible since probably before, I would say before 2010, they were not as easily accessible. And the proteomic methods that we used, they were even less accessible and are more recent. But with some of these techniques we actually developed in our groups. That's why we were in a good position to do that. And I think it simply didn't occur to people that often. I mean, there is, when, if you go back in the literature, there are hints and discussions about that these cells evolve and that there's genomic variability, and actually mechanisms are known why this happens, in particular in tumor cells. But it was never really in that way put in the context of reproducibility of research results, because also that topic only came up in the last few years. And
So if the study goes on longer than those 3 months you're talking about, is the error rate larger as it goes on?
Yes, the cells continue to diverge. I think, so in a way, these cells are doing what every living organism is doing. It explores the genomic landscape by mutations to basically fit the conditions of it exists in the best possible way. So this is basically the idea of evolution, molecular evolution, then selection, that the genomes constantly evolve, and then the variants that are have an advantage under the conditions they live, they will prevail, and the ones which are less fit will disappear. I think we saw just a beautiful example of that, if that principle with corona, right? We see these waves of corona variants coming up and then being displaced by another variant which has a higher level of fitness under the population conditions that it encounters. So this is exactly the same in these HeLa cells. When they are in culture, they will mutate, they will explore the genomic space, and then certain cells which have a variant genome will have an advantage under the culture conditions and take over. And so this is basically a principle of living systems.
So you had mentioned the hard part of about reproducing the results that you guys got, and really any study for that matter with the HeLa cells, is the best way to compensate for that the method that you use? That way the method can be reproduced even if the cells can't be reproduced?
Yes, so this is a very good question. So we tried, and we have this paper was a paper in a string of papers we did to address this reproducibility crisis. And we initially tested whether the methods we used to generate the results were reproducible. Because you could, of course, it could also be that the methods are not reproducible, and then of course you would not get reproducible results. Mm-hmm. And then we tested whether the computer systems we used to analyze the results, the data, were reproducible. And we found that under certain conditions where these methods are applied in a careful way by skilled operators, that both the data collection methods as well as the data analysis method, the computer tools, are actually reproducible. So there's very little error or variability in the research results comes from the methods if they're applied properly. I'm not saying at all that all research results are done properly, but the potential is there that if the methods are deployed in a careful, competent manner, the results are reproducible. And then we said, okay, it's not the research methods that are the problem, it could be the cells. And that actually turned out to be the case.
Okay. So you mentioned the different labs around the world. I believe it was 13 international labs. Do we know where each lab received their cells from? Because there's a supplier, I would imagine, that has those cells specifically that they then ship them out to those different labs. And how does the cloning reproducing process of those initial cells before they ship them off, how does the selection process factor into how the cells actually start off? Isn't that probably an inherent bias the way they select the starting spot?
So the way this works is that there is a source where you can order these cells. And this is the ATTC, American Tissue Type Collection. And they do a terrific service to the research community in maintaining these cells in a highly quality controlled manner. So that is, and not just HeLa cells, but a whole range of other cells that are also available. I mean, similar, same situation with cells from a patient were made to grow in culture, and then they can be perpetuated in culture, and there's a repository at ATTC. Now, what they do is they will grow up the cells with very nicely controlled number of divisions, and then freeze them down again. So you can expand these cultures. Let's say let the cells go through 5 or 10 divisions, and then you have 2 to the 5th or 2 to the 10th as many cells, because it's exponential growth. And then they freeze them down in aliquots, and then this is what they sell or provide to the scientific community. And these cells are quite well characterized when they come from there. And what now the question is, what happens then when they come into a laboratory like ours or from these colleagues who provided the aliquots of the cells? And the insight is that these cells continuously undergo genomic variants, and the longer you keep them growing, the more division cycles they undergo, the higher is the likelihood that they diverge. And once you have variants in your culture, then it's exactly like with Corona, that some of these variants are fitter to survive, have a high degree of fitness under these conditions, and they will overgrow and displace other variants. So for instance, we found that one of the characteristics of these cells was that easily measurable is how long does it take them to divide, basically go through one cell cycle, cell division cycle. And the number of hours varied between about 20 and somewhat slightly above 30. Now, this doesn't seem to be such a dramatic difference, but if you imagine that you have two cells, or let's say you imagine you have 1 million cells that divide every 24 hours in a culture, and you have 1 million cells that divide every 30 hours, and you let them go for 100 division cycles, there would be almost none left of the slow ones. So the fast dividing cells have an advantage, and they will outgrow the other ones. So that's what we found, and that's basically the process that happens. And in the different laboratories, this process happens irrespective of the precise conditions that people apply.
Okay. Was one of the HeLa variants that you looked at less likely to have those unintended changes than others that makes it more preferable to studies like you did?
No, so this is a comment I need to make, a general comment to these cancer cell lines. So they are cancer, so every cancer cell is a different cell from a cell which is a normal body, right? So when we take a normal healthy cell, for instance, a skin cell, or a blood cell, a lymphocyte, which is a normal cell in a healthy body, these cells do not generally divide. At least they only divide if they need to for biological reasons, and then when there's enough of these cells, they stop dividing. So the growth of these cells is controlled. In cancer cells, this is no longer the case. So they have certain molecular mechanisms that are different from those in an analogous healthy cell. And one of the defects many cancer cells have is a defect in the control of DNA damage. So every minute of our lives, we accumulate genomic defects through radiation, through toxins, and so on. So our DNA in every hour of our cells is constantly under jeopardy of being changed, altered. And the cells, each cell has developed amazingly complicated repair mechanisms to basically repair this damage as soon as it is being encountered. So for instance, if someone goes to the beach in the summer and lays in the sun, then this person accumulates an enormously large number of defects, basically alterations in the DNA, and most of that is corrected through this correction or repair mechanisms. So this is extremely effective in a normal cell, but in many tumor cells, these repair mechanisms themselves are mutated. That means they don't function anymore as well as in a normal cell, and then these cells are more likely to accumulate more rapidly additional changes in the DNA, simply because the mechanisms that are there to repair them under normal conditions are now themselves defective. So that's why these tumor cells, like the HeLa cells that grow perpetually in culture, they are more likely to accumulate rapid increasing numbers of genomic variants than a normal cell would.
Okay. This next question is from Marta, a microbiologist out of Poland, who I've had on previously. And I paraphrase, did the study have an impact on labs' approaches when using the HeLa cells after they saw your findings? And do they at least make it more accurate by at least providing the genome of cells that they did use?
Okay, so this is a very good question, and this is actually unresolved. But as a result of this paper, we had the opportunity through the European Molecular Biology Organization, EMBO, to organize a workshop where exactly this question was discussed. So we had the opportunity to invite a number of experts from various fields of science, of life science. So for instance, people from the ATTC from and other tissue type, basic tissue and cell repositories, molecular biologists, geneticists, genomics scientists. And exactly this question that your colleague posed was discussed. What are the implications? So we have to accept that there is nothing we can do to prevent this diversification of the cells from happening. It's an inherent property of these cells. So we discussed what one could do, and there should be a report of that with some recommendations coming out, hopefully anytime soon. So the suggestions that were discussed had a big range of possibilities. So one possibility was to simply say, we have to accept that these cells are very variable, they evolve over time, and therefore we ban them from we basically say they should not be used anymore for experimentation. So this is an extreme statement and that, of course, is not really practical because there's no authority in the world who can say you are doing work. You're not allowed to work with these cells. Simply doesn't work. This is not how science functions. So, but that was one extreme position that was discussed and, of course, was relatively quickly rejected. Other positions were, well, one should discourage the work with these cells and only use them if necessary. But use maybe alternative cell types, which are more stable, do not have these defects in the repair mechanisms, and therefore do not evolve as quickly as alternatives. And so, for instance, one could work with induced cells, which are referred to as induced pluripotent stem cells. So they're more normal cells, they're not cancerous cells. But they have many other disadvantages for experimentation, for instance, their expense, how much they cost, the difficulty of maintaining them and generating them. So, and then there was the third kind of broad position was, well, if you cannot deal with the problem, if you cannot control it, at least you can document it. So that was exactly one issue that was quite intensely discussed, that everyone who writes a paper with HeLa cells and the experiments they did, they would be asked by journals, for instance, and funding agencies to append this paper, for instance, with a genomic sequence of the very exact HeLa cell variant they were using in the laboratory at that time. So the conclusion was from this expert panel that this last proposition is probably the one that would be the best for science, because not only would it contribute to the documentation of the experiment that was done in that particular study, but over time, if one had genomic sequences with the functional information of these specific cells that have this particular genomic constellation, this would become a tremendous resource for research how genomic variation affects phenotypes, basically how genomic variation affects the function and the of particular cells, which is inherently the key problem, the key scientific problem in cancer research.
Okay. Yeah, I think some of your recommendations, if I recall, were specifically two different variations of the HeLa cells that came out to be more different than the others. Yes. To at the very least, mention which one of those you use, because those could be the biggest difference between the two. Is that correct?
Yes, that's true. And that's very, very minimal recommendation. Mm-hmm. And then could it be escalated to for instance, say, okay, we request, or the journals would request that the genomic sequences deposited with along with the research results. This is now would be relatively cheap to do and is certainly feasible. And another recommendation would be simply to report how many division cycles the cells that were used in this study had undergone since they were received from ATTC. So, I mean, there's very simple things that could be done, which already would be a step forward, to very complicated and involved things, which are probably not going to be accepted by the easily accepted by the scientific community.
How important are the HeLa cells in your own studies and research with proteomics? And what is proteomics, if I'm pronouncing that right?
So HeLa cells are not specifically important for proteomics. So I can first explain what proteomics is. Mm-hmm. So every cell, every human cell, has a very large number of protein molecules. Proteins are a class of biomolecules. And there is, we have about 20,000 variants or types of protein molecules in our body. That's determined by the human genome. And every one of our cells contains in the range a similar number of protein molecules as there is people on Earth. So about 8 billion. And these proteins are basically the molecules that carry out all the functions and controls of the biochemical processes of the cell. And proteomics undertakes the difficult task to measure which proteins are present, to basically identify which proteins are present under certain conditions in a particular cell, and how this population of proteins changes when, for instance, the cell is transiting from a normal cell to a cancer cell state. And so this is currently based on these analyses are based on a technique called mass spectrometry, where we extract these proteins from a cell or multiple cells of the same type, and then we subject them to analysis in an instrument called a mass spectrometer, which tells us which proteins are present, how much of any protein is present, basically how many copies, and also additional things like whether these proteins interact with each other, whether they have been undergoing modification, basically they incurred damage or not. So there's a lot of in biologically relevant information that can be extracted from this data. And we use them in our group many times to test and benchmark certain technical advances that we tried to realize. But in the context of this study, we also realized that these cells, with their variants that they have acquired over time, are a terrific model system to study how a genomic variant, for instance, if a gene is mutated, how this affects the functional state of the protein, the functional state of the cell. So this is, maybe you have had interviews or discussions in the context of the terms precision medicine or personalized medicine in the past. So I don't know that, but this is discussed very intensely in the medical field and in general public. And that is basically the consequence that every individual person, basically every patient who goes, for instance, with a certain type of tumor, let's say with melanoma, skin tumor, into the clinic, that this tumor in this person is different from the tumor in the next person, and furthermore, the person A is different inherently from person B. So there is every disease, every tumor in a particular patient is different from tumor in another patient. And so the notion has come up that one would like to find out what is the optimal treatment for each individual patient. So rather than using the same therapeutic regimen for every patient, let's say, who has melanoma, one would say within these patients who have melanoma at a certain stage, there is variance how they respond to therapy, and we would like to fit the individual patient with the best therapy available. So this is a very, very intense research field right now, and I think it's the future of medicine. But in humans, you cannot experiment, right? Take a biopsy from a patient to say, okay, at time zero, the tumor had a constellation or was of a type at the time zero that's different, and then wait for 3 months and take another biopsy and see how this tumor evolved. You cannot do that in a patient. You have to, for ethical reasons, of course, you have to treat the patient the best you can, the earliest time point. But with cells in the culture, you can do that. You can wait and see how does the cell change its genome, and then you can say how does that reflect, or how do these changes manifest themselves in the, for instance, response to a particular cancer drug. So you have basically, you can do a tumor evolution experiment in vitro, and you can see how these molecular changes affect the, for instance, response to an available panel of anti-cancer drugs. And so this is what we recognized in the context of this study, that this is actually a very terrific system to study how does the molecular composition determine clinically important parameters such as response to a particular drug. And that's what we have been pursuing then a bit further.
This is just a thought experiment, of course, but if we were to make a clone of Henrietta using each one of those different variations of the HeLa cells, how different might each of those clones come out based on what we currently know?
So you think over the whole 70 years?
Basically just the different variations that we have currently today. If we took each of those different types of HeLa cells and we were to clone Henrietta Lacks in person, how different would she be? Like, how different are the changes to those cells that would translate into a certain type of person to, you know, be born out of those cells?
Well, they would be quite different, I think. So what we noticed, for instance, I mean, the cells are classified into cell types, right? So for instance, the skin cell has variation within skin cells, but skin cells generally look more similar to each other than, for instance, brain cells or to liver cells. And we found that these HeLa cells, these variants from these labs that participated, they sometimes, the cells looked closer to, for instance, different cell type than to other HeLa cells. So they diverged a lot. So I would assume that if one cloned Henrietta and were to look now, compare it, the original cell to the cells that were used in this study, the differences would be quite substantial.
Okay. So one of the things I was curious about is if these changes over time keep occurring, especially after 70 years, let's say another 30 years, is there a point in time where you see us not being able to use HeLa cells anymore, where they're not a viable option for us?
Well, they're viable cells in the sense that they're viable and that they're growing the cell and in the laboratory, and you can do experiments with them. But they're not the same cells as they were last year, if they were cultured continuously. Okay. And so I think the question then is, again, what does the experiment tell us? Are the results tell us from a particular experiment? How do we relate that result to the results others have generated from HeLa cells, but from HeLa cells which were very, very likely not exactly the same and possibly quite substantially different. And so that's why then these various options to how to deal with the problem were discussed, of which the most likely and practical would be to document exactly the genetic makeup or the protein makeup of the cells that were used for to create a particular study or result.
Awesome. So in 2020, you actually won the Marcel Benoist Award, and that's referred to as the Swiss Nobel Prize. What was it like being honored for your work after decades of work as the 100th prize recipient?
Well, it was, of course, a great joy and a great honor. And it also with a big sense of humility, because it is so that there is a person gets honored, but of course that person did was just one component of the accomplishments of a whole group. I mean, the way life science research today functions, it's highly connected worldwide, and the results that we and the advances we were able to realize as a research group over decades was through the contributions of literally hundreds of skilled and dedicated individuals. So it was very nice to receive this honor, but it is clearly it needs to be clearly stated that this is really the result of a large number of very talented and dedicated people who contributed to this progress.
Absolutely. So I've always wondered about competing interest on studies like yours and others, conflicts of interest, as most people would understand it as. How do you separate your work with outside interest and the science?
Well, so conflict of interest usually comes up in kind of two contexts. I think the one context is always financial, right? Do you, and this is, of course, very often comes up in the context of clinical studies where, for instance, a new drug is tested. It may be tempting to some to publish results that would indicate that a particular new drug that has been developed with a lot of resources might be beneficial to a group of patients. And then if this result is published, then that of course might have implications in terms of revenue generated by, for instance, by a pharma company. So this is one context where this comes up, where there's a temptation to maybe put the effects of a drug in a too positive light, or even to falsify the results to make it appear better than it is. I think there is a lot of control mechanisms that have been implemented, and I think cases of that are actually quite rare. It's certainly they do exist, but I think they're quite rare because everyone now has to declare. If you give a talk somewhere, if you write a paper, you have to declare interest in, for instance, drug companies or whatever, so that this at least can be displayed and is out in the open, and then the readers can assess, would this person even have a potential conflict of interest, or is it simply not there? Of course, this reporting is also maybe not always 100% accurate, but I think there is, all by and large, this is relatively rare that really abuse happens, a misuse in this context. The second area where conflict of interest occurs has more to do with career advancement. I mean, science is a extremely competitive field, and especially for young scientists, it is extremely difficult to establish themselves as independent investigators. And so there is oftentimes, and there is also dependencies in the field. Like, for instance, if I'm the head of a research group, I have obviously more sway, if you want to use the term power, more power than a student or a postdoc would have. So conflict of interest can also arise from dependencies that I could, as a senior person, I could advance someone, I could someone's career. I can maybe sit on a grant panel and judge the work of competitors, grant proposals they've submitted, and there the conflict of interest might be more of a type that it might be tempting to suppress someone junior who has the same idea as I have, and then turn down that grant. So again, this certainly happens, and mechanisms have been implemented in, for instance, grant review panels, in professorial appointment panels, in fellowship panels. Every time where there's a career decision being made by a committee, that everyone who has a personal relationship to a candidate or grant, or a person who submitted a grant in the case of a grant panel, then these relationships have to be declared. And then the person who has a relationship that is considered too close, for instance, a person is a trainee or is a former trainee or is a close personal friend, would be excluded from the evaluation of that particular proposal. So there is, it is when people work together, if there is power in play, if there's money in play, if there's prestige in play, there's always the conflict, the potential for conflict of interest. And I think the scientific community does actually generally a very good job of declaring these conflicts and to deal with them by, for instance, excluding a person from participating in a review or from at least declaring financial interests. So I think it is handled quite well, but certainly it is not perfect.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate your breakdown of that, because I think most people would automatically think financial, but having those other types of, you know, things that can come up, I think that's really illuminating. Final question before we wrap up. For upcoming biologists in any subspecialty, what advice would you give that maybe took you learning the hard way that might help them?
Well, for any upcoming biologists, first of all, I would say that I would congratulate them for being interested in biology, as it's fantastically interesting and obviously also practically relevant from point of view of biodiversity, point of view of disease, medicine, but also from simply learning what it means for a system to be a living system. It's a fantastically interesting field of research. It is now in probably the most interesting phase because so many techniques have been generated to create insights that simply were only a few years ago not possible. So it is a highly illuminating field under a very dynamic and with extremely large number of interesting research questions. So I think this is, as someone was interested in biology, they made a good choice. And secondly, I would say they should keep an open mind and really look out for questions which are fundamental questions and try to address them in some experimental system where it's tracked. There is a lot of kind of dogmas which have been established in the life sciences, and I think many of those will undergo change in the next few years. And this would there's great opportunities to do really interesting stuff. So, for instance, just an example, because we're kind of running out of time, 10, 15 years ago, when you went to school, hygiene school or medical school or similar, or even in the general public, the notion was that microbes are generally bad for you and you have to clean them away. You have to, especially in the US, you have the notion was, okay, you have to kill them. You have to bleach your sink after you have washed your dishes. You basically have to kill the microbes, keep them away. And then came the revolution of genomic techniques, where now one can measure the genomic composition of microbes. And now you can go anywhere, any sample, you can take your swipe your floor, you can take a sample from your skin, you can go scratch your head, you can go in your gut. I mean, and then you can measure the ensemble of microbes which are present in there. You can go to seawater, into the ocean, you can go into a dump. And the diversity and richness of these microbes is simply mind-boggling, not only from the number of microbes which are there and how they live and how they interact, but also our dependency on those. So if we didn't have microbes, if we killed them all, we would simply not survive. So we are dependent on them. And of course, once in a while, through specific constellations, there's microbes that make us sick. But by and large, we coexist in a mutually dependent relationship with an incredible number of microbes. Just last week, there was a paper published in Science where computer scientists have re-examined an ensemble of data, sequence data created from all kinds of microbial samples, and they identified in a computer more than 100,000 new viruses that no one even knew existed. And but they are out there, and they estimate by extrapolation that there may be millions of as yet undetected virus types out there in the wild. And of course, they all live, they all do something, they all interact. And so I think it will be an extremely interesting question, how all these microorganisms constitute an environment in which more complex organisms like humans can optimally exist.
Awesome. Well, thank you for joining again. I appreciate that you're still willing to go out and do science communication with random people about random subjects. So I appreciate that a ton. Also for expanding on our HeLa cell knowledge, because we kind of briefly touched on some of the basics, but to kind of dive into your study specifically, I think that was really great and kind of opening some of those doors to maybe think about some of the underlying issues with different studies. And for the advice that you gave any upcoming biologists, because I am sure that's going to be quite helpful, because I think a lot of the problem today is just trying to keep that open mind when there's so many, especially in the US, polarization on different sides of every topic. Yes. So I think that goes a long way. Yeah. Do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
No, thanks a lot for allowing me to participate here. And I hope this will be interesting to some. And I wish you good luck with your enterprise.
Thank you very much. You have a great day.
Thank you. You too. Bye-bye.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for sticking around for the episode. If you enjoyed this one, be sure to check out the other episodes as well. And if you do want to support the podcast, there's a link in the description where you can click see more, and it'll take you down to the bottom where you can see a link that says support this podcast. If you click on that, you can support the podcast with a donation of your choice if you want to. And if not, that's okay as well. As always, listening, sharing, that's the best way to support me. So feel free to do that if you can't put in a donation. Thanks, everyone.